talk about your process. You have poems that you call mass-produced abstract poems. Can you unpack that sort of...
Take that out of its packaging?
Yeah, what does that mean? What is a mass-produced abstract poem?
Yeah. Well, I think the reason why I'd say a mass-produced abstract poem is because those poems are being produced on a kind of assembly line. There's a very specific procedure laid out in advance.
What is the assembly
for
line look like?
Where the poems are going to come from? So the assembly line has there's several phases of production.
Phase one.
Well, phase one is probably there's probably a phase in back of phase one, which would be
pre-phase.
Yeah, which would, I don't know what that would be like. That would be pre-phase, yeah. Which is that's just I think that would be something like. I guess one question I have is where does this particular kind of material come from in the first place? I don't think it's coming from like.
Good question, Rob.
Isn't that kind of a good question?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, do you find yourself asking that?
Where does this material come from in the first place?
Yeah.
Like the abstract sort of...
Yeah, or any just like where these phrases come from, actually.
Uh-huh.
They don't come from the world. They don't come from literature.
Well, they might come from literature.
I don't think they come direct from literature.
Uh-huh. Okay, so where does this material come from?
I mean, I think they're literary phrases, but...
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're artificial phrases.
Uh-huh. But I mean, like, I feel that there's, you know, like in The Sound of the Fury, Quentin Compson's sort of thinking process before he commits suicide. All of Book 2 of The Sound of the Fury, sometimes I feel like your poetry resonates with that sort of fractured, desperate grouping together of things.
Huh.
I don't know if you've ever made that connection with...
Never made that. It's interesting. Like,
uh-huh.
Look at that.
Uh-huh.
So there definitely is a desperate grouping together of things.
Uh-huh. Okay,
there's an impatient cramming.
There's an impatient cramming. And this is pre-phase. Let's get back to
So pre-phase is wherever that stuff comes from in the first place. It filters in from somewhere. And it's floating around in there.
And you just
in
get...
In the back somewhere.
And you just get a phrase in your head and you...
No, so I don't start with a phrase in my head. So the way that these poems have worked is I started just doing...
Everybody checking in right now, we're interviewing Rob Hendricks on his mass-produced abstract poems. Pre-phase.
No, this is phase one.
Okay, phase one.
After pre-phase, when somehow that stuff filters in and gets in there somehow.
Uh-huh.
Then in phase one, everything that's in there just gets poured out. So what I did, for a while I was doing several pages of just putting stuff down every day.
So automatic
just
writing.
Just automatic writing, essentially, yeah. And then at a certain point, started going back through and calling out. Well, okay, so when I first started doing these, I would take a page.
When did you start doing them?
When I was living in Cambridge, summer of 04.
04.
Is that right?
06.
And or maybe it was summer of 03.
And how did this process that we're talking about differ from any of your earlier processes? Because I remember I'd find poems of yours that you had written by hand, and there would be lists of words on the top of the page.
Yeah.
And then I'd look at the poem, and the poem would be filled with half of those words.
Right, that's true. Okay, and those words also came from back there, but they came from back there in a different way, which is those were words that I liked, that I had in my head.
Uh-huh.
And that I didn't necessarily even know what they meant.
Right, but they were
and that they were in some way pushing on me.
Uh-huh.
And so I would make a list of those words, and then I would I would weave them in. And that's insightful. I mean, I don't think that's that much. It's not that much different.
Uh-huh. But since these are... Okay, since these are coming from, and they aren't just words that you like, but mostly images, I guess you do experience them maybe in some degree more than you would experience those words that you kind of framed some of your earlier poems around.
Yeah, well, but they're phrases, not just words.
Right, and,
And they're more, I mean... I think there's a wider range of registers or tones or something that those words could, or those phrases could find their way into, than a lot of those other words, which were generally more sort of out of the way, arcane kind of words.
Sort of baroque words.
Well, yeah, it's. I kind of wonder if this is sort of a baroque style of writing in general.
So both of them.
Yeah. I mean, especially these later... I mean, those poems that you're talking about that were based on a list of words were especially... I was especially interested in paying attention to sound at that point in a way that I haven't been in these mass-produced abstract poems.
Was that when you were writing euphonic sonnets?
Yes, that was when I was writing euphonic sonnets. That's what all of those were. And so there was... I mean, it was basically a combination of trying to pay attention to meter and rhyme and also trying to pay attention to the sounds of syllables against other syllables without any intentional disregard of meaning, but without any real attention to meaning either.
Okay. Intentional disregard to meaning. Which is...
There is no intentional disregard to meaning.
There is now, though?
No, there is never. There is not. It has never been. There's never been any effort to not have meaning.
But
there's always been a struggle for there. There's always been either a struggle for there to be meaning or a letting go of that struggle, but there's never been an intentional, willful disregard or... Yeah, willful disregard for meaning or willful rejection of meaning or intention to be... incoherent or something like
right.
that.
Right. So we have a pre-phase and a sort of like a gestating period.
Yeah.
And then we have phase one, which is automatic writing. And is there another part of phase one? Is there like a two-part phase?
No, that's all of phase one. So the automatic writing piles up, basically. Mm-hmm.
So you just have like... And this is where it becomes like a sort of where the mass production comes in.
This is where mass production gets rolling.
Okay, because you're piling up.
I'm piling up automatic writing, and it stacks up, and I don't necessarily refer to it for a while. Like, the stack that I'm still working on, I have from, like, 2003.
And what would be sense in your automatic writing? Like, anything from, like, stock phrases?
Anything from... I mean, most of it is not useful for this purpose.
Uh-huh.
So then phase two is actually a process of sifting through that, basically gleaning for phrases that are useful for this purpose, which are sometimes, on a rare occasion, there will be a few pages in a row where it's just chock full of great stuff, but usually it's anything from... I mean, mainly it seems like it's mostly very... like it's super ego voices, like thinking about what I should be doing or what's wrong with me or what's going on in my life or something.
Uh-huh.
Like that. But so then there's like other voices that find their way in there in the meantime. And I mean, in some ways I feel like that's what I'm doing in making these poems, is that I'm creating a space for those other voices to be listened to.
What are you talking about?
I don't really know what to call them. I mean, it seems like they're subliminal voices or they're like deep image voices. I don't really know what that... I don't have any language psychologically for what that part of the self is or whatever. But.
So phase two is kind of a sifting phase?
Yeah.
And you look for just anything that jumps out at you, basically?
That jumps out at me, yeah, I would say. Especially in the sifting phase... I'm pretty liberal in what I take. Uh-huh. And I get that down in a list in the same way that you have seen the lists of words uh-huh. for those small poems uh-huh. that I used to make.
Right.
That were euphonically oriented. There will be a huge list. Usually I'll end up having like a 3 or 4 page list of phrases
uh-huh.
That then I start with once I have that list
put
together.
Those phrases usually full sentence phrase? I mean, are they phrases or are they just full sentences?
It can be anything from a short phrase to one full sentence.
Uh-huh.
And that actually what those... what gets on that list has actually been a variable in the process.
Uh-huh.
Something that has, you know, given some
interest
to the process.
Kind of like the table of contents that we saw.
Yeah, that table of contents came out of the several of those lists where there was a period where I was just saying, oh, this looks like a title and pulling it out.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So that's where I got all of those.
Okay. So phase two is sifting and list making. But now we have a really big jump, right? Because we,
this is
the easy stuff, right? Or
this is the, it's yeah. I mean, it kind of feels like it's all the easy stuff.
Uh huh.
As long as there's time for it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like when it gets less easy is when there's a rush or when there's not uh-huh. enough space to actually get the job done.
Okay, so time for it. Like, what is that time period look like? What's that? Are you just kind of like?
Well, I mean, I guess what it seems to me like the process really requires solitude and silence for it to work, because uh-huh. otherwise there's a lot of bad decisions that are made,
uh-huh.
and the product ends up feeling rushed and ends up having less emotional resonance, less, in some sense, less coherence.
Uh-huh.
Not that there's ever a certain kind of coherence, but I think there is a certain kind that comes out of being really deeply engaged with the material rather than kind of superficially engaged with it while I'm also thinking about a billion other things because I'm distracted.
Mm-hmm. Which in some ways is some of the feel of a lot of your poems is like a sort of meaningful voice trying to break through the sort of distraction of these huge sort of images that are bombarding it constantly.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. Are the images the distraction, or are they what needs to be heard?
Right.
It seems like, I mean, I think that my orientation towards the material is that those images are to be what is there to be listened to.
Mm-hmm.
But they sometimes, I think when they're not being listened to is when they're experienced as a distraction by the reader, maybe.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is a total hypothesis.
But going back to a question I'd written down yesterday.
Do I feel as if I'm trying to insult the reader?
Yeah, do you feel as if you're trying to, or not that, but like, I guess, you know, you're saying like, are they distractions if the reader isn't listening to them in the right way? Or does sometimes the reader just say, like, why the hell am I reading this poem? You know, it's, and like, and especially like if you're reading it out loud and you're struggling with it and you're like, I wasn't able to read that last line to give it any sense, and now I have to read the next line and try to give it sense, even though I didn't do it with the last line. I'm kind of feeling mocked by this.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know if that's fair.
No, I think that is part of the experience. I think that's fair.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I have that experience as a reader. even
right.
with poems that are not remotely trying to do that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so do I.
And I think that there
but
are
I mean, that's
poems
just where there's...
I think there are poets who are trying to do that with a different purpose. And I think that, I'm not sure that that's the primary intention of what I'm doing, but
uh-huh.
I think that is part of the experience of this kind of poem.
Is wondering whether you're being insulted by it or not.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think it is. And I think it's a decision on the reader's part as well. I think there's some freedom for the reader in terms of deciding, you know, how to relate to that.
Right.
I mean, you can decide, this is a waste of time. You can decide,
uh-huh.
this is charming and bizarre, and and maybe decide to go back and reread a billion times and continue to be frustrated, probably. Or you can just decide to accept it and keep plowing ahead and take what you get, which I think is the orientation I have wound up, where it's just the kind of like what I wanted to do with that kind of poetry.
I guess so. There is a point when maybe it's not worth it to trudge forward through that poetry, kind of like when John Ashbery talks about some of his poems that he doesn't like, and he says that they were more difficult than they were rewarding, I guess, in relation to your poems, since they are so difficult. Do you feel, or could you describe why a poem didn't work, or when it, you know, when a poem doesn't work? When, I mean, you know, you got two side by side, one that's both are equally difficult, but I guess what is that essential thing that makes one work and one not work?
Right. Well, I mean, it seems to some extent like it's temperamental, and I mean, it could be for some people that all difficult poems are not worthwhile. And obviously there are a number of people who find those poems of John Ashbery's that he doesn't like himself to be rewarding.
Like Self-Portrait and Convex Mirror.
Oh, no, like Tennis Cordove, like
right.
These language poets who are basically dismissive of everything but those poems.
But there are poems that you feel just didn't work, that fell flat. I mean, outside of the subjective...
Okay, let me say this. There are poems of mine that I feel like feel flat to me. They're, you know, relative to each other, there are poems that feel very luminous, just palpably beautiful and wonderful.
And you think...
And there are poems that feel empty and like just kind of like a rushed exercise.
And you feel that the only thing that really divides those two poems is that in your process... You were allowed time and solitude to sort of let those other ones foment in that other period.
I really do think so. I'm not 100% sure, but I really do think so. And I find myself wondering, how can I? And I think the answer is there is no other way. But I still find myself asking myself, how can I make a space for that this same kind of process to exist in ordinary time? Because generally, my experience is I go on retreat, I write poems, they come out great. I write them in the context of my everyday life. They come together in this this way that is not really satisfying to me.
I guess this would be a good time to ask you what exactly your relationship is to John Ashbery's poetry.
Well, it's... I think it feels to me like it's part of, at least a part of it. I don't know if this is a cop-out to say this, but... is a kind of perverse desire to engage with this body of work that is so, in a way, strikes me as being especially controversial and kind of an irrelevant way, of course.
Controversial to the world of poetry.
Yeah, and the world of poetry.
And that it really is outside of all the other norms that are going on.
It's simultaneously outside of all the other norms that are going on, and also sort of prototypical and even canonical in its kind of, it seems like there are basically two attitudes towards it, one of which is just a kind of stupid dismissiveness, which doesn't appeal to me at all. And the other one is a kind of idolatrous obsession.
That
which,
would work.
Which, frankly, is a lot more, feels a lot more right to me than the other. But I guess part of the feeling that I don't feel like I necessarily, I definitely don't feel like I'm deeply moved by John Ashbery's poetry in the way I am by a lot of other poets. I don't feel like it speaks to me in a, even like super... well, it is extremely enjoyable, but mm-hmm. it's not... When I think generically of the pleasure or the enjoyment or the gratification of reading poetry, I don't think of the experience that I have reading John Ashbery. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I think I started out wanting to engage his poetry in a deep, broad way, just in order to confront that strain or that climate in American poetry, or that what's going on in that culture, or
the climate opposite to his poetry, which is everything must be so very clear,
clear, simple, kind of charming and funny.
You need to
kind of down home.
You need to front load your poems to make them interesting, like you would a journal or a news article, so that you know the reader will be engaged. Kind of, here are the outlines to get a poem published.
Yeah.
Type of attitude.
Yeah, I think
in
so.
Poetry today.
And I think probably the next step for me would be is going to have to be to confront that strain as well with a poet who is actually doing something pretty remarkable and amazing. I'm not sure who that poet is or whether they exist, but maybe it's you, Joel.
Maybe it's me. Well, I mean, Billy Collins for.
Yeah, but actually, Billy Collins would be. Billy Collins
just,
is
just such a
fucking.
Yeah, he's a great
fantastic,
poet.
Yeah.
I mean, people criticize him for being
perfect
at that
yeah.
thing, but
perfect.
On the other hand, he is just incredibly entertaining. And
that's exactly who it would be.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah, I do completely want to read him.
Mm-hmm.
So my relationship, I would say at this point, my relationship to that poetry is that I want to keep at it. I feel like it's a wonderful inroad into modern art, into. Kind of, it's a wonderful inroad into a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
and it's
important, it's
a beautiful, mysterious world. I love it.
Do you want to go ahead and read one of these poems?
Yeah. Mandolin Tunings. I'm trying to be friendly with the whales, but disrespectful of the universal clientele. Not for a day, but for the rest of life, trampling the eaves and rafters to rest on the arm of a long, warm divan, the ornamental wagons gliding by, lined in back with colorful shirts that exist on the market like so many contraceptives on a plate. This doesn't dwell in everyone. There are other deities and powers, heat without illumination in their sockets like flies, whose inactive minds bother to seize the common gates, who resemble in turn the head of a snake, a carnivorous waste, a morning mass, and something that is nothing other than thin fire. They draw the blinds around themselves, neither asked for nor grasped, but somehow apprehended, contained. Some species of ant stands at the corner and begs for water. Its declarations are all irregularly hymned, the simple seasons out of the dusky heart, the radiant mind slower than the minds that made it, the lifeboat of love, the wild mincemeat, a microcosmic stoop that holds on its anvil forefingers wings and the wind cornered in sand. It wears no apron, which tires no man. It waves torches and chants on the lawn of its investment in us. And all clammed up in its featureless claws are glass wedges of sore eyes for the truckload. The prom and the biotech banquet wrap round its mandibles. It pours the material down itself in a kind of culinary warfare. Clean as a daisy, I was called to, in pressed white linen. Almost at a crawl, as the rowers row in uncertainty of a proper conclusion, I stepped down from the alcove, across the carpets, bleeding little animals, into the backwoods lofts with the oxygen plants, to explain what they'd conceived. The first revelation. Whether of the glorious embrace, or the tame departure, or the karmic forgiveness when we are all near death in the moment of uncertainty.
One thing that strikes me about that poem is, even though there's, even though it's very abstract or difficult, just uses a poetic maybe timing or structure, like I noticed that at the beginning, up until the contracept is on a plate, there's like a very light tone in the poem. In the phrase is like, I'm trying to be friendly with the whales but disrespectful of the universal clientele. Very light. And then right after plate, there's a density that begins that seems to get lifted when you get down to some species of ant stands at the corner. And then that's really great because in that middle section you do spend pretty much a whole time around the ant, even though maybe on the first couple of readings the person couldn't tell that you were still with the ant, but you actually are with the ant by the end of the end of that stanza.
Right, you're still with the mandibles. Pouring the material.
You've never left the ant. And then into this very difficult ending that, I'm not quite sure what it's about, but it feels very mournful, very but also very near like some sort of like that point at the end of the diary of a country priest when he says, it's all grace as he's dying, type of a thing, like this very big forgiveness for the whole sort of thing that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's a feeling that I walk away from it at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're using, even though that there are these very obscure phrases going on and you're calling it mass-produced abstract poems, you're still using these things to pull them off, which I think it might be important to note or think about, especially with the putting comedy next to density or lightness next to density that allows a poem to move and allows a reader to be engaged in it. Whether it's completely absurd or not,
I think that's true. I think that's a major, a major technique or a major source of pleasure.
Yeah.
To me personally, in any art, actually.
Right.
I'm finding myself wondering, listening to you talk just now, I was thinking that I wonder to what extent what I'm trying to do when I'm making these poems is to make a kind of simulacra of religious awe, or trying to build towards a moment of wonder at profound greatness, or
that sort of
mystical ecstasy or something. I feel like that you and I talked before about sort of the abuse of theological language
in our poems in the past
to try and put some kind of cheap sublimity or something in. But I think, and I think, I mean, it's interesting that what happens in this poem is right after the contraceptives, we get to deities and powers, and like, there we go. Like, I really wonder if there's any other way that I ever move towards that kind of. I would like to, I mean, I'm going to be paying attention on looking back over poems to see if there's other ways of. Are there other ways of approaching into that?
But like like that other deities and powers reminds me of like in a poem I've written where I talk about the domestic gods of people. You know, it's that sort of Old Testament when Jacob and his family are fleeing, they make sure to bring their domestic gods with them. Or else the deities of the rivers in Greek mythology, not necessarily like that one, that line in particular doesn't have the same sort of references to the sacrament, which is probably a pretty big one that we hit on earlier in our poetic career, to like bring off any, you know, like any sexual, any, like some like sort of mix of like sex and the sacrament was always like some sort of great achievement for us back in the day. Which, I mean,
I think that was especially for you, actually.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I feel like maybe we read over a couple of poems. But
a little thing like that. Yeah, no, it's true.
Well, all I'm saying is that that seems different. That line seems particularly different than that other thing that you were.
Right, and that it's not. There's not awe in that line. That line is making a gesture towards something fascinating and strange, actually. You know, who resemble in turn the head of a snake, a carnivorous waste, a morning mass, and something that is nothing other than thin fire. Uh-huh. And the morning mass there is being lumped in with other sort of carnival wonders. So. I don't think that we get to the awe until towards the end of the poem, but it's kind of grows, and that's a step towards it. And yeah, that's okay. So that's a good point.
I think we got off track of your process a bit.
Yeah.
Did you want to get back to it at all?
Yeah. So did I answer the question that you were actually putting to me just now, or did I evade it?
I think we're going to listen back and see if there was even a question that we got around to. Well, you talk about solitude and silence as being an important aspect of your poem making, and that comes in at this sort of vital moment where. I mean, I guess kind of it's the alchemy that moves it from lists of things into poetry.
Right.
And do you think that you are investing some sort of, I don't know, hope of spiritual insight in that moment? Like, I mean, they seem like such, you know, I guess, you know, every poet says, like, oh, I need solitude and silence to write my poems, but, I was just wondering.
You don't need solitude and silence to write poems?
No, I do.
Oh, you do?
Well, maybe. I mean, I would say, like, I mean, there is that, like, sort of Bukowski aspect of, like, you know, you write poems when you can write poems, and, I mean, I guess you do that, too, of course.
Yes, but they suck.
But they suck. but that's, I guess that's the point we're at in the process. So what happens then?
Well, I don't think that I'm investing it with hope of spiritual insight. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I think that I do believe that I do experience it as the process of writing and the product itself as something that contains a lot of being. or a sort of purified being or a sort of clarified being.
Uh-huh.
And it's not so much insight in any sense of affecting change, personal change, or being able to do anything differently, but that it is a sort of, that the poem itself is good.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like this distillation.
It's a poem. Treasure. Uh-huh. It's a way of like dwelling with a treasure, or prizing, or deeply valuing goodness. It's a form of contemplation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So once you get...
See what Ryan has to say about that.
When you get it into poem form, or when you're moving it from list, do you then go and say, like, okay, I'm going to use iambic, I am going to use...
Not these poems.
They just...
I don't do that. They, I take the words and I... So then what I do is I go through the lists, this is where things get a little murky. I do, like, change it up, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes the list, like, I'll have rules about what can be on the list.
Okay,
for instance, only complete sentences. Mm-hmm. Or, like, there's a poem in here.
Out of the Deadly Terebinths.
Here's a poem that came from that. I'm deciding that I was going to only use short sentences. Out of the Deadly Terebinths. It's golden. It's a chair with a dragon on it. Is trust sold? The soulless were convinced. Resentment rises with the challenge. I'm going. The cranks were painted. The results are meant to set goals. Ugh. Indulge my territory. It was a joke. Crack the husks, spelling bees, piano recitals. Stay with one book. A centerpiece puts itself before its time. Rod's ring. Her letter allows for more wallpaper with cars on it. She coats her tongue with the wax of 1,000 diaries. She's a helmet. Her parents were firstborns. Everyone bleeds. Get the time, the polka ride. They split. Your accent through them. I present. Idealists travel convinced. Groups sit. Deluxe terraces yield no dividends.
So, can we go through that just really quickly then?
Yeah.
Would you have then, out of a list, say like, it's golden is on one page, and then on the next page you have the line, it's a chair with a dragon on it, and you somehow felt, oh, those two sentences go together.
Yeah.
I mean, but even though, like, initially...
They weren't initially close to each other.
Yeah, they're like...
And that's... earlier in this, when I was first starting to do this, I would take 3 pages in a row, and I would go through, I would cut out, I would first, basically I would edit those 3 pages into one poem.
Uh-huh.
And those 3 pages are the actual automatic writing, not the lists.
Uh-huh.
They're, like, I would just take 3 pages of automatic writing, condense it down, I would basically just distill it, condense it down to one poem.
Uh-huh.
It would basically be consecutive. I would chop out stuff that was, you know, hideously prosaic or banal or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then tighten it up and then formalize it somehow.
Uh-huh.
So the day, that poem, The Days, was written that way.
Okay.
And that was actually the first one of these that I did in that sense.
Uh-huh.
It was the first time I ever took that writing and converted it in that way.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Right.
But then gradually I started sort of broadening my range, the range of where I would draw the material from, and also not keeping it consecutive, but sort of composing it according to intuitive, basically according to pleasure principle, I would say.
Good principle.
Yeah.
But this has also been, I mean, along also with the process of doing it as you just described it, it's also been a process of allowing yourself to do this too.
Right. Yeah, it's something that I have had a really intense fascination with and desire for, and also something that I've had a lot of, I mean, you know, there's a lot of voices. I mean, just in terms of, you know, going back to the question about relationship to readers, like, I think I really do have a desire to be connecting with a reader.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of fear around not connecting with a reader by getting into this this way of going at things.
Do you feel like you might be, I mean, I think in our talks through the years, one of your fears or tendencies is to isolate yourself from people. Do you feel that that is one of the tensions that you've, I mean, that you worry that, that through your poetry you're trying to distance yourself from people and that you had to overcome that fear to allow yourself to do this process?
Well, I think that what I would say is that, I think that I did have a fear that this, not so much, I wouldn't say that that was what my fear of these, of wanting to write these poems was about. I think my fear of wanting to write these poems was just of being perceived as all of the things that someone who writes this kind of poem is frequently perceived as being, you know, elitist or pretentious or intent or willfully, what's the phrase that we have here running through this whole thing?
Willfully.
Trying to insult the reader.
intentional.
And willfully insulting. Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't want to be any of those things, and whether I am or not is another question. I mean, probably I am.
Sure.
But I think, but I think that the bottom line is like, yeah, exactly. And I think the bottom line is that is who I am, and that's something that I want to do. And I think that that is a point of, ultimately, that's not a point of isolation. That's a point of profound connection and companionship and contact with people. Because and even if they are insulted, even if they're my good, I have good friends who are put off or insulted by these poems, but who, because they love me, still come back to them. And engage with them.
Yeah. Do you want to give a shout out to any of those good friends right now?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking especially of Chris Knight,
yeah,
who's a very good friend.
Yeah,
one of my best friends.
He wants,
and you know, he just he his tastes are different,
right?
But I think that he there's still he's getting to know me by seeing those poems to some extent, and you know, he loves me, and so that is. That feels connecting. It doesn't feel isolating, even though he doesn't really like the poems.
Well, I like the poems. They terrify me sometimes, but I don't think they isolate me. I lost my question. Oh, Jenna was wondering yesterday whether or not, I mean, and she called you cagey.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, and that you are suspicious of what others may do to you if they could see through these poems, maybe. So that you're trying to... Well, are you trying to hide something, you know, maybe subconsciously or consciously?
Of course.
Through these... Yeah, sure. But do you think that...
Was that a cagey thing to say?
Yeah, of course. Well, what kind of things do you think are sublimated in these poems that I mean that you could identify, or would you feel comfortable identifying anything that
if they weren't sublimated, then I would write them out the same way that I write out poems that are not abstract. I mean, I do have poems where things are put pretty straightforwardly.
Sure, yeah.
And those are the things that I can tell you. I mean, if it's sublimated, I sure as hell can't tell you what they are.
Well, maybe you intentionally sublimated them.
No, I wouldn't intentionally sublimate anything.
You would never do that.
I'd never do that.
That'd be the same.
Anything that is sublimated is completely, you know, determined for me by powers beyond myself.
By the process.
No, I mean, I'm sure that I've intentionally sublimated things, but the whole point of doing that was so that I would not be able to remember them, so I don't remember what they are.
Fair, that's fair. Okay,
I mean, I guess another way of saying it is I'm interested in knowing myself, but I don't want to overdo it.
I'm interested in knowing myself, but I don't want to overdo it. I'm going to have to write that.
I mean, it seems kind of like, I also, part of knowing oneself is knowing one's limits for knowing oneself.
Do you feel, when you're writing these poems, that you maybe should be thinking about writing a different kind of poem, or you get people saying, why are you writing these poems? You could be writing a different
poem. Yeah, everybody gives me shit.
Does Ryan McDermott give you shit?
Yeah, even Ryan.
Even Ryan?
Actually, no, yeah. No, I mean, I do, I feel like I get a fair amount of passive-aggressive feedback about how I should be writing something else. I do feel that way.
Right.
And I do, you know, on some level, I mean, I do have genuine desire to write other kinds of poems, as manifest by a damn good poem that I wrote recently. That I could read on this at some point.
You could read it right now.
Should I?
You want to read a contrast?
This is unsublimated
version. As unsublimated as a poet can get, I guess.
This, I don't think it gets any less sublimated than this. Getting the papers to you for Debbie Tolman. I thought when I suggested that I come meet up with you wherever, that I could drive toward you after dropping off the priest, O'Malley, at St. Peter and St. Paul's. But then Durrell called up and said to drive around on Larkin to Bill Graham to get the PR people, Sally, Faith, and Chi. But Lonnie got there first and took them back, and Sally bitched at him, and I was free. I should have waited for you there. I knew or should have known, if I was thinking straight, that you would get there pretty quick by BART. You were still in the mission eating lunch, so I decided to go back and park and get myself a snack from Specialties. Hot barbecue pork on focaccia and a cookie. You arrived downtown and called before I'd finished paying the cashier. So I turned out to be the late one, and you didn't seem to care that much that you turned out to be the one who had to wait. Once I was almost to the library, I called, and you came out and climbed aboard the Scion at my invitation. You had lots to say about your documentary, and nothing much about the dissolution, except to ask me where to go and what to do to get it done. I stopped nearby the courthouse so that I could let you out. I think I may have kissed you on the cheek again, like I've been doing lately, though not too often since it's rare I see you now, and even rarer that you kiss me back. Who knows why I would want so much to squeeze you tight like this and kiss you, but I do. I guess what I would say after reading that is that that is putting something forward difficult, but not that difficult.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Right.
So I would be interested to try to put something more difficult forward at some point, when I'm ready.
Difficult as in?
As in, like,
emotional.
Hard to reveal.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Authentically. I mean, that's what I mean, what I like about that poem is that I feel like I'm putting something forward that's pretty much like, I mean, that formally, it's not heart-wrenching, it's sad.
Uh-huh. I think for some of the readers it was pretty heart-wrenching.
Well, that's good.
I heard Derek cry.
Yeah.
For like 10 minutes or something.
Good. Well, it's cathartic for them. Yeah. I mean, I've been getting my, I got my catharsis other ways in relation to that. But no, I mean, I'm sure it was cathartic for me writing that as well.
I think, I mean, what's interesting about that poem too, though, is that there is a lot of unspoken tension going on in the poem, and a lot of the poem is about what isn't getting said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how Debbie mentions nothing about the dissolution, and how there's a lot of, for you, no space in which to say anything, to express your emotion, except, I mean, in the poem you do, but in the scene that you've created in the poem, you didn't.
Right.
And that...
Right.
I guess that's, in a way, a good picture of maybe what's going on with these other poems, too, you know.
Mm.
This is your space. This is where you do get to put energy into something that you really love that maybe no one wants to hear.
Mm.
Who fucking cares? Like, because you get to put it in a poem, and it's really a point of joy and excitement. And for you to do this, and maybe you'll get an audience. Maybe you won't, but it is creating a space for yourself, I think.
Mm.
Do you have anything to respond? I mean, that's not really a question, but...
No, it's a it's a pretty... I think that's pretty accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, I think conversely also... I don't know about conversely, but also... I think that that kind of space existing in my relationship with Debbie, where there's no room for that kind of thing to be said, is not... I don't think that's just about my relationship with Debbie. I think that's even more essentially about my relationship with myself.
Uh-huh.
And I think the kind of space that exists for me in writing a poem is as dense or... I don't know how, I'm not exactly sure what I'm trying to say here, except that I think those poems need to be as abstract and murky as they are, because that's the kind of space that I have to be authentically self-revealing also.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's also like, I mean, you said I'm not interested in being too self-revealing, and I think...
I'm interested in being as self-revealing as possible, but I just would like to be realistic about that and kind to myself.
But also, I mean, there's a certain extent to where there is no audience for extreme self-revelation. I mean, it's like, there's always this...
Extreme self-revelation is pretty boring, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, so what? You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's what's working for the poem. I'll be revealing as much as it works to create attention in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if I tip my hand, then it might not be any good. Or
right, you're right.
It's just, you know, boring. Or it's pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Something like that.
Sure.
Is there anything else you want to say about your process?
Did we get to the tail end of the process?
No, I don't know if we did.
Let's see, where did we leave off here on this?
We got clarified butter. G.
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 I think that after that composition process is finished, there's very little that's left.
Uh-huh.
I think there's
just some pruning.
Occasionally some pruning or some minor adjustments to syntax or word order or line breaks or blah blah
blah blah blah.
But it's minor. It's not like there's a lot of revision necessary for these.
I asked you about your difficult syntax yesterday, and you said that you use it to show off, to intimidate, and because it's fun. But I'm wondering if maybe you're using it in certain, especially in these, is because you're bringing together sort of disparate
There's phrases. Needs to be room for a lot of lists.
Yeah.
A lot of convoluted sentences are necessary in order to bring those disparate phrases together. Absolutely right.
So you're going to have a lot of...
And that's why it's a challenge to write a poem that has just a bunch of short sentences.
Right.
Because they're going to be just as disparate. And it's an interesting result. Right. But
so, I mean, in a sense, you said you aren't doing it because I have a complex idea to communicate, but that was just a sheer lie, wasn't it?
No, that was true.
Because you do have a complex list to communicate, at least.
I have a complex experience to communicate.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. So we're at the end.
All right.
We have a poem. Do you want to read one more poem?
Absolutely. How about two more?
Okay.
This one is not a... this is a short reflection on the Eucharist. I don't have a title for it yet.
And this,
if any of my listeners out there have any suggestions for a title, I could use some help.
And this is not a mass-produced abstract poem.
This poem was not mass-produced. It was produced in a small cutting board in a basement under a heat lamp.
Also, I just want to ask this question just really briefly because it just brought to mind. You said yesterday maybe that something like this short poem that you're going to read feels more like a poem to you than the abstract, mass-produced abstract poems.
You said it feels more like a poem to me?
Uh-huh.
Ooh.
Or like when, after finishing it, you felt like you had just written a poem.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I was paying a totally different kind of attention to language and experience.
Okay.
I was
so maybe
trying to...
You yesterday.
Yeah. It feels like a totally different kind of poem is how I would say it today.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I don't know if I like it better or not. This poem has nothing to do with... there's no sex in this poem. How few small early buds surround the host. Unpressed and altar palmed. To dress and ghost this table. Dressed as buds. But dressing, blessed. To host the one who comes as ghostly guest. And I think this is also specifically, I'm not just trying to write about the Eucharist, I'm trying to write about my experience of liturgy at St. Gregory's.
Right. Can't just title it liturgy?
No.
That's a bad title.
I have no idea what I could possibly title it.
Poem.
little poem. The wraparound state. We are never alone. Though enraptured, we plead with the stars for a hedge of battle-scarred windmills. We try to pull loose of the chamomile tea. We babble too close to the curtain. We are irresolute. Oh well, we're all distracted by something. The mandrake's spike, for instance, never washed nor hung to dry. The forbidden smoke pooling in the garden. The crowd of hangers-on scoffing. Not to speak would be betrayal of the senses. I think of his crying after the ballet and of his demonic laughter. All things are not equal. The night is flatulent. The night here is not that serious, but the asphalt of evening, the white triumph that coats it like a sheen of ice, or like shawls outspread for you and the others to tread on, explains why the cows move so unbearably slowly, idling in the lanes even, actually. Horizons of green or purple or lovely white from behind the shape of the hand shaping the words slide along the fence. The clone who lifts huge weights with his mind, clogging the throats of millions. His eyes were moist, as if there were almost no story to tell, or as if beneath the shrouded glass banisters it was tested on a capable audience. unveiled, and despaired of by those who seek a way back. Untied from the gravities and grandiosities of feeling, we do not retire from our search. The benevolence of the skies comes on stronger. We are blanketed with stars. We are older than the dancers in the dreams, those with plates over one eye. It was his wish to see her smile back at him out of the gray mist, encouraging the distance and the big crash of consciousness in which the flavors mingle and collide. But more like a raven on a peninsula looking for an angry fist beneath the flexing of the linoleum, since she was raised in Chile and was laced with a mildness, a knee-jerk philosophical naturalism wherein the glands freeze, she precipitated not a song about the arbor grass, nor the dross of charity, nor involuntary subscriptions to all the papers, nor the value of string in summer, nor touching the one you love with a stroke of ideal genius, but clusters of grapes, spears of rye, spears of rage, sparrows, and an untastable substance like glass upon the grates and funnels of the regions of unbelief.
Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Joel.